I can't believe I won.
And you still got people out there with double masks and face shields and shit. Look into it.
You can tell it's real because it looks so fake.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Look Into It. Tonight, we have a special episode. Dr. Andrew Kaufman recommended this doctor to me, and, I don't question it too much. I know that this is going to be a fascinating episode. Please welcome Dr. Tom Cowan. How you doing, Tom?
I'm good. And you're Eddie, right?
Yes. Yes, I'm Eddie. For my audience, can you please give us a background on how you got into the medical field and what your mindset was growing up and how you ended up questioning, like viruses, for instance, and what heart attacks or what causes heart attacks. I want to get into that, too.
All right. So I grew up, sort of normal. My father and grandfather were dentists and a lot of their friends were doctors. And I was mostly doing sports but I was, good in school and all that. All I could say was I didn't like medicine. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. So I ended up going to university at Duke. And I didn't like that very much. And so I got out of there in 3 years. I graduated just because I wanted to finish. And I joined the Peace Corps and taught gardening in Swaziland. And I didn't know what I was going to do with myself. But it was in Swaziland where I met the work of Weston Price.
What's Swaziland?
Swaziland is a little country near Johannesburg in South Africa.
Okay.
Teaching gardening, trying to figure out what to do. And then I realized, people gave me books and stuff by, Rudolf Steiner and Weston Price. And it hit me then that the kind of doctor I didn't want to be was not the only kind of doctor there was. This was when I was 20.
And what was this book about? What kind of?
Well, it was a bunch of them, but one was about that traditional people who Weston Price studied basically never got sick. And there was 14 groups of people that he was a dentist that he studied all over the world. And they all had perfect teeth and never had any illness. Hmm. And it hit me then that there was a different way of doing medicine, a different way of looking at this whole thing. I mean, I didn't know that, I didn't know anything except what I was taught in school. I just had a sense that it wasn't right. And then it was sort of like a dam broke. And so now that's 46 or so years later. And pretty much every day since then, I've looked into what's real in medicine. So I go from there, and then I decide I could go to medical school, not really knowing exactly what kind of doctor, except I decided then that I was going to leave no stone unturned. In other words, if I found out that it was best to eat calf's liver every day, I was going to go with that. If I found out it was best to eat Brussels sprouts every day, I was going to go with that. If I found out whatever I found out, I was not going to be prejudiced and say, well, that isn't because what I was taught or anything. And I made a lot of mistakes through the years, but that was my principle of trying to figure out what's true and what's real. So over the years, I discovered, and wrote a book, The Heart Doesn't Pump the Blood. That's easy to prove. Blocked arteries don't cause heart attacks. Easy to prove. Vaccines are no safe or not effective. Easy to prove. Cancer is not a genetic disease. It was easy to prove. And then you know, as I got into it more and I learned how to learn, I learned interestingly, when I decided to go to medical school, I read the complete works of Sherlock Holmes because I thought he knew a lot about the thinking process. And he said something very interesting. Not, you know, not he. It was a writer, right? What's his? Can't remember the right. You know.
Sherlock Holmes didn't actually exist, right? It wasn't based on right. a real guy, right?
Yeah, it was. It was a fictional book, but okay. Anyways, he's talking about the process, and the process was: don't worry about what's true, only try to figure out what isn't true. Which, in other words, you can't prove there's no such thing as a virus, but you can demonstrate that nobody has proven that such a thing actually exists. There's a subtle difference there. You see what I mean?
I totally get it. Like, you can't, like, you, if Neil deGrasse Tyson said the sun is a trillion miles away, or if it was in a textbook, some astrophysics textbook, there's no way to prove that it's not, you know? So same thing right. with the actual number they give you. The sun is 93 million miles away. You can't prove that it isn't, but they can't prove that it is either.
Right. So I focused on disproving, you know, whatever I, you know, came up against. And over the years, you know, heart is not a pump, cancer not a genetic disease, vaccines aren't safe, viruses have never been shown to exist, and most of the things in modern biology and medicine are basically make-believe. And so once you do that, then you do come out with, as Sherlock Holmes said, once you get rid of what's not true, it actually starts becoming clearer what may be actually the true. So that's really what that's been my guiding principle my 45-year career. And then I retired I just couldn't be part of medicine anymore, basically. So I quit, surrendered my license, and now I'm just doing this.
Fascinating. Now, in regards to viruses, Kaufman, he made a great analogy. He basically said, and I'm sure you've heard this and you may use this, is a blaming a virus for a sickness is like blaming maggots for killing a corpse. Would you agree with that?
Sort of, except maggots actually exist and viruses don't.
Yes.
But, you know, Eddie, there's a very simple way to figure this out. If I can run you through the process.
Yes, I want to hear it. Take your time. I love this stuff.
And so, you know, what I'm going to do, if you're okay with it, is use you as a kind of foil in this.
Let's do it.
Okay. So, and the important thing in going through this is to get very clear and very basic. So let's start. So let's say, how do you know something exists? Let's say a tree. How do you know there's such a thing as a tree?
We've seen trees. There's a tree in my front yard.
Okay. So let's make a principle out of that. And again, tell me whenever I say something, if you don't agree, just say, I don't agree with that. Right.
Okay.
But if you do agree, then say, so you go to the place where you expect to find trees, you make a definition of what you're looking for, and then you go and see if you can find it. Now, usually you see with your eyes, but you know, if you're blind, you could still, you know, feel the tree or maybe even hear the tree. So it isn't just seeing. You can use one of your senses. You go to the ecosystem where the tree you expect it to be. You see if you see it. You might ask your friend, do you see the same thing? And if everybody says yes, you know that there's a tree. Does that sound right?
That sounds right to me.
Okay, let's do a frog. How do you know there's such a thing as a frog?
Same thing. Feel it, see it, maybe smell it.
What? Give me the whole process.
A frog?
Yeah.
Go to a pond.
Go to a pond with
a video camera
or a net.
Yeah. Yes. We got to capture it now. We can't just see it. Okay. We capture it. We see it. And then we have our friends confirm that we're not
making it up.
Exactly.
Now, let's take it another step forward. How are you going to figure out what a frog is made of?
Dissect it. I'm no scientist, right. So yeah.
Yeah, but maybe you know, let's say you're a mean person, so you kill the frog.
Yes.
And then you cut it up into little pieces, see if it's got legs and eyes and all that.
Just like in 10th grade.
Right. Now, what if I said to you, okay, Eddie, the way to know what a frog is made of is to take a big scoop of the pond and take the scoop out and dissect everything in that scoop, and then you'll know what a frog is made of. What do you think of that?
That doesn't make sense.
Because why?
Because you're collecting a bunch of stuff that isn't frogs.
Right. This is really simple. The first thing you do is so-called isolate the frog.
Yes. Yes.
Right? Yes. In other words, you want just a frog.
Yes.
Now, you can see what a frog does, like do frogs catch flies? So you could sit there and watch the frog.
Yes.
And you don't even have to kill it. Yes. But the important thing is, when you do an experiment to see what it's made of and what it does, you have to make sure that you're only studying a frog.
Correct.
Right? That makes sense?
Makes sense.
Okay. Same. How about a bacteria? You can't see it, can't smell it, can't feel it. But how would you find out if there's a bacteria that's real?
Collect water, a certain amount of water, and then try to find the bacteria floating around in it.
Right. Now, there you may have to use an instrument like a microscope to extend your vision, right?
Yes.
But same thing. If you want to know what a bacteria is made of, what do?
You isolate the bacteria itself.
And that means just the bacteria, right?
Correct.
Not the bacteria and the fungus and the protozoa and the yeast and everything else.
Yes.
Okay. And if you want to see whether a bacteria makes somebody sick, you don't have them swallow pond water, even though it may or may not have bacteria. You just have them eat the bacteria.
Yes.
Right? You with me?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I would venture to say that process is the same for everything we do in determining whether something is real, what it's made of, and what it does.
Correct.
We go to the ecosystem where we expect to find the thing. We see, feel, we may have to use extended instruments or something, and then we see the thing, we smell the thing, we feel the thing, we take the thing out. In other words, we get only the thing, and then we study it, dissect it if we want, and see what it does. Right?
Yes.
Okay. So that's very clear. There's no problem with the process. Now, let's take another step here. Let's say we have a situation with something that you can't find. Let's call it a make-believe, a jing-jing ball, right?
Okay.
Now, I tell you, Eddie, this jing-jing ball can knock down walls. It's a great invention because now we can demolish buildings. All you do is throw the jing-jing ball at the wall, right?
Okay.
Now, I'm going to prove it to you, Eddie, that it works. I have a bucket. And I make a wall of not a very solid wall, just a crappy wall, right?
Yes.
And I put stones and rocks and glass and nails and screws in the bucket. And I'm not sure if there's a jing-jing ball in there or not. Okay. And I take the bucket and I throw it at the wall and the wall knocks down. And I say, you see, that proves jing-jing balls exist and knock down the wall. Do you buy it?
Yeah, that's horseshit. Yeah.
Why is it horse shit, as you say?
You didn't prove anything. There's a bunch of other stuff in there that
right
on the wall. Yeah.
Right. How do you know it's not the nails and the screws and the rocks and all the rest of it?
Yes.
Okay. That's very clear, right?
Yes.
In other words, unless you found the Jing Jing ball, isolated it, right?
Yes.
And threw that at the wall, and then maybe you might even like pretend throw like air at the wall, just so you're sure it's not just the motion of your hand knocking the wall down. Like, that would be a really specific, you want to make sure it's not looking at the wall, it's not doing like this at the wall, it's just the Jing Jing ball.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
There's nothing that I said, I don't think, that's like weird or anti-scientific, right?
Not at all. Not at all. Sounds like the scientific method to me.
Right. Okay. Now let's apply this to virology. Number one, and I'll point this out, I will, you know, I can prove it if you want, but you can take my word for this and anybody listening. There is not one paper in the scientific medical literature that has ever found a particle with the definition of a virus. Let me give you the definition. Is a replication competent, meaning it replicates itself, protein coat, genetic material in the inside that reproduces inside cells, right?
That's the definition of a virus. That's what they're saying.
Yeah, okay. That's what they say. That's what everybody agrees on.
Okay.
That thing has never been found in any fluid tissue sample of any sort from a human, an animal, or a plant. Period. Not from a chicken pox lesion, you know, the pus.
Yes.
Not from the mucus of somebody with measles. Not from the spine of somebody with polio. Not from the lungs of somebody with COVID. In no case has such a particle ever been found in any of those fluids.
So what do you say to people that say, well, you're wrong? There's a...
No, everybody agrees with that.
Really?
Everybody. 100%. Really?
Isn't
that's
there
very...
Like, isn't there like a like some kind of microscope, like one of those...
No,
like,
no, Eddie, hang
microscopes?
On.
Yeah.
Stick with me for a minute.
I'm with you. I love it.
Everybody agrees that looking directly in the fluids, you cannot find the virus. They looked for 20 years, 30 years with an electron microscope. They never found the virus.
Sam Tripoli and I are coming to your town. Catch us on the road doing tinfoil hat comedy. Follow me on Instagram at tinfoil hat comedy night. September 8th, we'll be in Dallas, Texas. And September 9th, Austin. Go to samtripoli.com for more information and to buy your tickets. See you on the road.
Okay.
And everybody agrees. Now, if you ask a virologist, why can't you find the virus?
What virus are you talking about specifically?
Any virus.
Okay.
Polio virus, smallpox virus, HIV, Zika, Ebola, SARS-CoV-2, any virus, rabies.
They never found any of those.
Not in any fluid.
Okay.
They say there's not enough virus to see in the fluids.
Okay.
Which is odd, right?
Okay.
It's like I go to the forest to find a tree and I don't see any trees. I go to the ponds and I don't see any frogs. I go to your mouth, I look for bacteria, I don't see any bacteria. Why can't you see the bacteria? There's not enough bacteria to see. So how do you know it's there, right?
Yes.
Okay, so first step, and I could prove that to you, but I don't think we should waste time on that. Everybody agrees so far. Now, there are approximately, let me take a guess, 10,000 papers in the medical literature that have the title, The Isolation of Zika Virus, Smallpox Virus, SARS-CoV-2, Coronavirus, Measles Virus, HIV, etc. 10,000 yes. papers, right?
Okay.
But so the question is, Why are they saying they found the virus? What did they do to find the virus? Right? That's what we want to know. Because exactly. they say that in the title of the paper.
Yeah.
I found the measles virus. Now, here's how they do it. And this is the crucial thing that I want. If you don't understand what I'm saying, I want you to stop me and we're going to go over it.
Okay.
Okay? Because they say this is how they find it. This is how they prove the virus exists. Now, remember the Jing Jing ball experiment.
Yes.
Okay. This goes back to 1954 with a very specific paper. He took a child with measles, right?
Yes.
Now, he doesn't know there's a virus or not, right? Mm-hmm. Because he never found it before, right? So you have to find it first. He takes some of the snot from somebody with measles.
Okay.
And then he puts it through a filter, which gets the cells and the bacteria out.
Okay.
But that is not a virus. That's hundreds or thousands of proteins and amino acids. And who knows what is in there, right?
Yes.
Nobody says that's a virus. They think there might be a virus in there. Right?
So in the papers, they're saying they didn't find it.
Not so far.
Okay.
All they have is filtered snot.
Okay.
Which they hypothesize has a virus, just like we hypothesized that the bucket has a Jing Jing baller.
Correct.
But they didn't look for it. They didn't look. They did look before. They couldn't find it. So they say, well, we have to do something to find it. Okay.
Okay.
So they take that filtered snot and they spread it on monkey kidney cells, right? That's a culture of cells. And then they add horse serum, fetal calf serum. They take away the food of the growing cells, right? And then they add two different antibiotics, amphotericin, gentamicin, which have been proven to kill monkey kidney cells. Okay?
Okay.
And then they put it on, there's some milk in there too. And then the cells die. They say, this is the key, that is the definition of how you prove the virus exists. That's called isolation of the virus.
Yeah, and they didn't isolate anything.
Well, they say they did.
Yeah.
But you're saying they didn't because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, how do you know it wasn't taking away the food of the cells that killed the cells? How do you know that the antibiotics didn't kill the cells?
Yeah.
How do you know that something else in the sick person's snot didn't kill the cells? How do you know the fetal calf serum didn't kill the cells? Right?
Yeah.
You know what the answer is? You don't. Now, can I screen share here?
Absolutely. Yeah. Screen share all you want. Showing videos, anything you want.
Okay, let me show you this. Okay, right? So you're clear on what they did.
Yes.
They took snot, filtered it, didn't look for a virus, put it on some cells, added antibiotics, fetal calf serum, took away the nutrients, the cells died, and they said that proves the virus killed the cell.
And why did they add all that stuff? Like, what's their reasoning? What do they say? Why don't they just put the snot on the monkey cells and then that's it?
Because they say you have to use antibiotics to kill any bacteria that are in there, so you know it's not bacteria. They say that's the antibiotics. And they say that it makes it easier for the cells to die if you take away their food. That's true.
That's hilarious. They say that?
Yep.
Wow.
Okay. So we decided, Andy, you know, Dr. Kaufman, as you called him, and I, and a guy named Stefan Lenke, who used to be a virologist, we decided to run this experiment again. Right?
Yes.
So we took cells. You can see in the upper left-hand corner, my left.
Yes.
So those are cells. We added a little bit of antibiotic, and that's it. 4 days later or 5 days later, they were growing fine. Right?
Yes. The monkey cells.
The monkey kidney cells.
Yes.
Then next experiment, we took the same culture. They were growing. We put in 10% fetal calf serum and a little bit of an antibiotic. 5 days later, they were fine. Okay? You can see that.
Okay.
Then we took the cell culture. We took away the nutrient medium, just like they do in 100% of these experiments. We added a little bit of fetal calf serum, 1%, and we added the same antibiotics that are added to all the different cultures. And 5 days later, the cells broke down, proving that there's a virus, but at no point did we add anything that could have a virus into this. So what killed the cells? Either the taking away the nutrients or the fetal calf serum or the antibiotics.
Yes, interesting. What a great experiment. You did the same thing, except you didn't put in the mucus.
We didn't put in any snot.
Yeah.
Then we did it again. That's the fourth column. We took away the nutrients, same antibiotics, same calf serum, and we added RNA from yeast. Got it?
Mm-hmm.
No virus, no snot, nothing from anybody with measles, mumps, COVID, HIV, anything. Right?
Right.
Cells broke down in 5 days, proving their existence of a virus. That means we isolated a virus, even though there was no virus possibly in this mix. Now, here's what's even more interesting. We then... you've heard about the sequence of we sequenced the genetic pieces of RNA in this mixture, right?
Okay.
And we told it to make the SARS-CoV-2 virus sequence, and it did, proving that SARS-CoV-2 is in there, even though there's no chance that SARS-CoV-2 or any virus is in this mix. And then we asked it to sequence the genome of measles virus, and it did, proving that measles virus is in this culture, even though there's no chance of a measles virus. And then we asked it to sequence the genome of HIV, and it did, proving that HIV is in this culture, even though there's no chance that any virus was in this culture. Proving that they threw the bucket and they said that proves there's a virus. At no point did they actually even look for a virus. All they looked for is the wall fell down. We threw stones at it. We threw rocks at it. We threw things at it. One of them must have broke down the wall. One of something in the snot, something in the RNA from the yeast, something in the antibiotics. That must have broke down the wall. We have no idea which one it is. And they say that proves the existence of the virus.
And this is the method that they still use?
They used it with every SARS-CoV-2 experiment, every single one, every Zika, every HIV, every Ebola, every measles. This is the way, not a way. This is the way they prove the existence of viruses.
Wow.
Let me just go on here for a minute.
Okay, go for it.
Now, okay. But somebody will say, yeah, but Tom, I've seen pictures of viruses. How, like, so what do you mean they don't exist, right?
Exactly. That's what people.
Now, yeah, here's what they do. They take this culture, right? This broken down culture, and they look through an electron microscope for what they see. Now, let me just point out something. In order to get an electron microscope picture, you take this snot, this broken down culture, right? And you freeze it to 120 degrees. You macerate it. You centrifuge it. You put heavy metal dyes on it. You evaporate the water. You shoot an intense electron beam at it. And then you get a picture.
Yes.
Now, if I said to you, Eddie, I want to know what your hand is made of and what it does, and here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to cut your hand off your body. I'm going to put it in a blender. I'm going to freeze it to 120 degrees below zero. I'm going to stain it with metal stains. I'm going to dye it. I'm going to shoot an electron beam at it. I'm going to get rid of the water. And then I got a powder on the table. And now I know what your hand does. What do you think of that?
Yeah, it's
bullshit.
Ridiculous. Yeah, totally.
All right. So that's what they did. Now, when I say I'm going to look at the picture, I don't mean this picture, right? Because this is that's a computer picture.
That looks like a planet.
Right. Or this picture, right?
Yes.
Because if you listening or watching out there think this proves there's a virus, then you think that proves there's unicorns. Or that. Now, I personally don't think this proves there's unicorns.
Yeah, the background though looks like what NASA actually uses for space.
Right. Okay. You mean this picture, right?
Yes.
Okay. So that thing there with the arrow, that came from that culture. That somebody did, and they said, look, there's the SARS-CoV-2.
I'm Eddie Bravo, founder of 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu with over 150 schools and over 30,000 soldiers worldwide. Music has always been my deepest passion.
Without that musical journey that I took, I probably wouldn't be here right now. I can't tell my music story without having my musical partner my whole life and best friend, Mr. James Watson.
I said, I want to be in a band no matter what. Oh, well, there it is. I gotta move to Los Angeles. I said, I gotta go to that place if this California is supporting metal.
Me and James just started making music.
Mastering the Metal, the story of James Watson and Eddie Bravo. Print and audiobook available now.
There's another picture. You see the spikes and everything, right?
Yeah.
Now, here's a paper published in Kidney 360, August 2020, that says you cannot tell the difference between electron microscope pictures of kidney biopsies or lung cancer biopsies versus any virus. And so they attempted to show it. They said, these little things you get are just the cells breaking down. They break down into nothing. And then you stain them, et cetera, and you get these pictures and you cannot tell the difference between that. And so here's a whole article. Even this clathrin protein is the spike. They say that's not a spike protein. That's a common protein found in all kidney cells and all lung cells. That's not a corona or a spike. And so they go on and then they say, and I'll let people read this at their leisure, we knew about this at least since 2003, and we have studies showing that you cannot tell the difference between broken down cells from kidneys versus a virus. And remember, the thing you're looking at is broken down kidney cells.
So they're admitting that, like, they can't tell the difference.
They admit they can't tell the difference.
Now, why would they admit it? It seems like this is like this. Why would they blow the scam and admit it?
Well, they don't all admit it. Like, people like these guys write papers. And I, by the way, I have what I call my pumpkin challenge test, which is I have a cat named Pumpkin. And I
so
taught him.
To, I have a cat named Pumpkin, too.
And I taught him to say yes or no. So I showed him. I can show you this.
Show me.
I call it my pumpkin challenge. Now, so here are. Here are all the different studies showing that no virologist can tell the difference between kidney biopsies from the 1990s, before there was SARS-CoV-2, allegedly, versus SARS-CoV-2. There's one study. There's another study. That is kidney biopsy. There's The Lancet. There's this journal. We suspect that the electron microscope images of SARS-CoV-2 published to date are, in fact, they're called multivesicular bodies. That means just debris from the kidneys. Hmm. Okay, Eddie, is that SARS-CoV-2 or kidney biopsy from the 90s?
SARS-CoV-2. No, I'm kidding.
Incorrect. How about that one?
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't know because you can't tell.
Yeah,
now,
I have no
you,
idea.
People, there's the arrow. People looking out, they're going to say, well, I can't tell because I'm not a virologist or I'm not an electron microscopist. I can guarantee you I can show this to any electron microscopist and they will not beat Pumpkin. You can't tell. These are either kidney biopsies or SARS-CoV-2. There is nothing to distinguish between them because they are all kidney biopsies. All of the electron microscope images turn out to be just dead and dying debris from broken down cells, period. There is no such thing as a virus. All these images are dead and dying tissue that is stained and dyed and frozen, etc.
Now, what about the Spanish flu? What are your feelings on how that went down? Was that just another scamdemic like the one we just had? Was that for political reasons? Or, I mean, a lot of people died, right?
So let's talk about the principle here, right? So a lot of people say, well, a lot of people died, so it must be a virus, right?
Yes.
Let's see. So the principle is if a lot of people have the same symptoms and die, that proves it's a virus, right?
That's what they say, right?
Okay, let's do it. Let's do an experiment. You move into a new house and there's hundreds of rats in your basement, okay. Right?
Okay.
Somebody unbeknownst to you puts rat poison down in the basement. You go down the next day, 10 rats have bled to death. Next day, 20 rats bled to death. All same symptoms. Next day, 30 rats bled to death. And so on. Same symptoms, one after another, same place. Therefore, rat poison is a virus. Is that right?
No, I see what you're saying. I'm with you. So what do you think? So what do you think was going on with the Spanish flu? It was like the flu, right? Flu symptoms or similar.
But it's important to be systematic here. Remember Sherlock Holmes? He said, "Don't jump to what's trying to figure out what's real. Try to figure out what's not real first."
Yeah, because if they still haven't found. What a virus. I mean, for sure.
So back here's what they did. Here's what they did in the Spanish flu.
Okay.
They took 100 or so people, or volunteers. They were prisoners, basically. And they said, if you let us expose you to people with the flu, we'll see whether you get sick. So they took that, these 100 people who'd never had the Spanish flu, no symptoms. They put them in a room with 5 or 10 people who were coughing, fever, and they blew snot up their nose. They put their mouth this far apart and blew into each other's mouth. They injected them with blood, etc. This is called the Rossignol experiment. In those 100 examples, they said not one person got sick.
And what's the name of the experiment again?
It's called the Rossignol experiment.
And Kaufman brought that up too. There's a website we can go to check that out, right? Do you have that? Do you have it real quick that you could just throw it up on your
screen? No, I don't have that real quick.
Okay, we'll put it in post.
Since then, there's been approximately 15 to 20 similar studies where they take people who are sick and expose them to people who've never claimed they've never had that. And there's not one case that we know of where anybody got sick.
And they're literally taking snot from sick people
with a syringe and shoving it up their nose.
And there's been 15 to 20 studies done.
Yes.
And then nobody gets sick.
Nobody gets sick.
Isn't it crazy that people still think spreading snot or touching someone else's snot and touching your nose gets you sick? I mean, that's like everyone believes that. Common knowledge. You know,
I would point out that even if somebody got sick, that obviously doesn't prove it's a virus, right? Unless you think that the only thing in a snot of somebody is a virus, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's ridiculous. So even that experiment wouldn't prove it's a virus. But if it's negative, which they all are, 100%, Eddie, then you don't have to look further because you know there's nothing in the snot that makes somebody sick, which is why. So here, contrast that. Here's how they proved polio was transmissible. 1907 experiment. Okay?
Break it down.
Here's what they did. They took somebody with paralysis, a boy,
okay,
right? Now, you don't know why he's got paralysis. You just know he's got paralysis of his leg. And then you take a biopsy of his spinal cord, right? A piece of his spinal cord. You grind that up in a blender. You mix it with some saline and some other stuff. And you inject it into the brain of two monkeys. One of the monkeys died and the other got paralyzed. And they said that proves this is a transmissible agent. Now, I don't know about you, but they didn't like just inject saline into the monkeys. They didn't prove there's any virus. They just said if we inject monkeys into their brain with this goop from a diseased spine, that proves it's a transmissible agent. Now, you know how many people in 45 years of a general medical practice said, you know, Tom, I was walking along the street and I was fine, and somebody came up and injected, you know, half a liter of spinal cord goop into my brain, and boy, I didn't feel well after that. You know how many times that happened?
How many?
Never.
Exactly.
That doesn't happen. And in all of their experiments, when they say they prove that the snot makes animals sick, what they do is they take the snot, filter it, anesthetize the animal, stick a tube down their throat, stuff the snot down their throat, unpurified. They don't do a control. The animal gets a cough, right? Because they just... it's stuck lung goop down their throat, and then nothing else happens and the animal's fine. That's how they prove that you transmitted the disease. And then when they look, they say, oh, we see a genetic sequence with a PCR test in the snot, and we see the same sequence in the lung. That proves the virus reproduced. But what that really proves is you took some genetic goop from the snot, you put it down in their lungs, and 3 days later, it's still there.
I want that upper body clench. That's what I'm
I'm going after. With the underhook, looking for double underhooks. Fucking, that's a juicy ass clinch. The perfect double underhooks, you're on your side, boom. That's all perfect. That's huge. In my game, for me, I'm like, I got this motherfucker. First fight in Abu Dhabi 2003 against Gustavo Dantas. I got right in and got double, perfect double underhooks. I'm like, oh my God, I had him in a lockdown, perfect double underhook, really quick. He just gave it to me. I'm like, and I was just sitting there going, oh my God, he just gave it to me. That was just off a front headlock, 100%. Push into him, you wanna smash him, and then jump on that leg. You wanna rush him, so they don't have a, so they're off balance, you jump on that leg, try to, you hook that leg, you're gonna take their back or put them in the truck, either one. Does that make sense?
Correct.
This is nonsense.
Now, can you speculate a little bit into like why they're doing this? Is this just purely for money, big pharma, or is there a more nefarious reason? Do you think? What do you think's going on? I mean, because this has been going on forever now, at least 100 years with these viruses, right? Polio and
it's about 145 to 150 years.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think it's just a way for the it's just a way to control the masses, a way to control the slaves? Is that's just part of Empire 101?
Okay, so I try to be very careful here.
I get it.
Because I don't ascribe motives to people unless they tell me, why did you do it? Well, I'm trying to enslave the people. Then I would say, can I tell that to the people? And they say yes, then I would. But here's what happened. They, in the latter part of the 19th century, the 1800s, there was a radical change in how people saw life. They decided, based on no evidence, that the only things that exist are physical substance. There's no love, there's no fear, there's no nothing, just substance. And so then, because you decide that, you have to start looking for evidence that that's true. It's not the other way around, where you say, I wonder what a living thing is made of, right? That's how I would do it. And yeah. Then you start looking. They decided that there must be physical things that cause disease. And so they couldn't find them because they didn't look at poisons and all, and, fear and emotions and slavery, and all that wasn't part of the equation. They had to find a physical thing, started with polio. They couldn't find it. So it must be invisible, right?
Yes.
Because we know it's a physical thing. And so then they got an electron microscope. Then they could see it. And then they said, there it is. And then they found out that wasn't it. And then they figured out a different way. That's the cell culture, to, quote, prove that that little thing was causing disease. And then it just took off like wildfire. Now, to your question, was there a nefarious agenda behind that? I mean, maybe.
I mean, just look at what's going on with Fauci and Bill Gates and, the whole scamdemic that we just went through. I mean, it's pretty obvious that there's some kind of New World Order agenda about this, right?
Maybe. Let me just say, that's not my issue right now.
Okay, I get it.
Because I don't actually care about Gates and Fauci, because if you get rid of him, you'll get somebody else who thinks the same thing.
Exactly. They got 10 people in line waiting to take
the problem is how we think. The problem is we believe in stuff for which we have no evidence for. And in fact, 120 or 30 years of evidence says there are no exploding unicorns, no matter how much you think there are. They don't exist. because you cannot show me the evidence that one exists or a virus or that bacteria cause disease. Bacteria, you can isolate easily, right?
Yes.
You can expose people to them. And there is not one study showing that isolated strep or anthrax or pneumococcus causes disease. Not one.
Like, what about staph? Not even that?
Not staph. None. What happens. Something happens to break down your tissues, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like starving or fear or arsenic or chemtrail dust, right? All kinds of stuff.
Yes.
There's thousands of different things. Your tissue breaks down, and then the bacteria come to eat the debris, just like they do everywhere else in nature.
That's the maggots, right?
That's the maggots. And then in our wisdom, we say, oh, you have an infection. And so we kill the bacteria, which makes the process stop, right?
Yes.
And then you're left with a dead dog. And this, you get the symptoms go away, but now you've got a rotting flesh in you, which will create more and more problems. And then they keep doing it because the same thing happens again. And next thing you know, you've got a bag of debris, right? Because you couldn't digest it. And that's what we call cancer. So you can see how just imagine this, or here's another example. You get a splinter in your finger, right?
Can you take a screen share off so we could see you a little bit clearer as you explain this?
Okay.
There we go.
Okay.
And if you want to share anything, feel free. I just, if you're not sharing anything, I'd like to see your face while you're
okay.
talking.
So you get a splinter in your finger and you don't take it out. What happens next?
It could get infected.
Let's be precise in our observation. You get pus.
Yes.
Right?
Okay.
You don't know whether it's infection or not.
Okay.
Right? Do you agree or no?
Yes, I do agree.
Okay. What's the purpose of the pus?
It's probably a good purpose, like your body trying to push the toxins out or something.
The splinter.
Yes.
Right? You've ever seen that? I have. I got a splinter. I couldn't get it out. I waited. It made pus. Got the splinter out.
Correct.
So the pus is a therapy for the splinter.
Yes.
The splinter is the disease.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
The pus is the medicine.
Yes.
You agree?
Yes.
Okay, now let's do another example. I put debris in your lungs, maybe like cigarette smoke or, chemtrail dust or something, right?
Yes.
Then what happens? Same thing. You make pus to get the debris out of your lungs.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
We call that pneumonia or bronchitis.
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Pneumonia or bronchitis is the therapy for the debris in your lungs.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Now, you don't feel good, right? Because your body mobilizes fever to make it easier to you get the mucus out. And you cough to get the mucus out, right?
Yeah. And maybe I thought about this too. I don't know. Maybe you get tired and bedridden.
Yeah.
So that your body goes, listen, I got to do whatever I got to do to have him conserve his energy because we need to work on this for a while. So let's make him feel like shit and make him lay down until we take care of this. Something
right.
like that.
Exactly. Right? Makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Then you cough it up, no more debris, and then you're fine again.
It's just like pain, like if you get you put your hand on a hot stove, it's gonna hurt, right? It's supposed to hurt so that you move your hand.
Right. So you're supposed to get mucus. You're supposed, and the bacteria help because they eat the debris in there, just like they do everywhere else in nature.
Now with staph, because I deal with staph a lot. I teach martial arts for a living, and we get people with staph every now and then. It's always been around. Now, when I noticed some people, they go natural and they don't take any antibiotics or whatever the doctor gives you. And it takes them longer to heal, but then they end up healing on their own. And then, but most people, they do, they go to the ER. They, if they let it get too crazy, they lance it, but then they get them on antibiotics and it seems to clear it up. What,
okay. Let's walk ourselves through. So go back to the lungs. So you get debris in your lungs, right?
Yes.
Then you get mucus to cough it out.
Yes.
And somebody comes along, goes to the doctor. The doctor says, because he doesn't understand this, you have an infection. So he gives you antibiotics. And because the bacteria were helping you get the mucus out, the mucus stops coming out and you feel better. Right?
Right.
What happened to the debris? Still there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So what's going to happen next?
You tell me.
It'll do the same thing all over again. Okay. So then you get, quote, sick again, and you start getting rid of it. And okay. Then you go to the doctor again, gives you another antibiotic, and then it goes away. And then it comes back, and it comes back. Now, you do that 10 times, and you're also keep putting debris in your lungs, right? Because nobody told you not to.
Exactly.
So now we have a situation of a whole lot of debris in your lungs, and you were thwarted in getting it out, right?
Yes.
So what would you do if somebody put a whole lot of garbage in your house?
You'd take it out. First you'd beat his ass, and then you'd take it out.
Okay.
You'd make him take it out.
Right. But tell me if you agree with this. The process of taking it out would be you'd put it in a garbage can.
Yes.
Then you take it out.
Yes.
So that's what your body does. You got all this debris in your lungs. It puts it in a garbage can called a tumor. Now you've got lung cancer.
Mm.
So what do you do next? Well, you take it out. And then what happens? The guy keeps putting more garbage in your house.
Yeah.
Now he not only put it in your garage, which isn't so bad, but he put it in your spare bedroom, and then he put it in the living room, and then he put it in your bed, and then he put it in the kitchen, and now you can't live there anymore. Right? Yes.
Yeah.
And that's called metastases. So originally you got there because you tried to get the debris out, but they stopped it. The debris stayed, it built up. Your body tried to say, okay, we got to deal with this. So let's keep it out of the general circuit, you know, general body. We'll put it in a garbage can in the garage. That's a tumor.
Yes.
Now you keep putting more and more garbage in because you don't know. And the doctors give you garbage in the form of antibiotics and chemotherapy and vaccines and chemtrails and all the rest of it. And you get more and more garbage, and then you have garbage all over your house, and then you die from cancer. That's how it works.
Mm. Now, so you would suggest staying away from antibiotics, even in the case of staph?
There is no evidence, Eddie, that staph causes any disease.
But they always say that if you don't treat it, you could die. You could get your arm cut off. I mean,
they say a lot of things, Eddie.
Okay.
I don't believe like any of them. So here's the problem. If you understand what I'm talking about, you will do a few things. One, stop putting garbage in your body.
Correct.
That's what the staph is living on. Number two, you will facilitate getting the garbage that's already in there out of your body, right?
Yes.
Like take the splinter out. Now, yes. If you do that, I did that for 45 years. Nobody lost their arm from staph or strep or pneumonia, and it never gave anybody any antibiotics. Because all I had to understand was, okay, stop putting garbage in, and facilitate, and there's techniques which we don't need to get into to do that. I mean, if it's a splinter, you stop putting the splinters in, right?
Yes.
And you take a tweezers and you pull it out, and then the pus goes away.
Yeah.
There is no possibility of staff living in a situation where there's not dead tissue.
I understand.
Just like there's no maggots if the dog is fine.
Exactly. Exactly. So
that's not that complicated to understand.
What do you recommend? Someone has staff, they're gym rats. Do you recommend just eating a clean?
You know, it's not actually that helpful to get into specifics about this. I need to know the story and how they live and how they got poisoned and what they do.
Okay.
Because it could be, you know, for instance, guy gets 3 COVID shots. Next thing you know, he's got a staph infection. Why did he get a staph infection? He didn't. He got poisoned. And then the staph is very good at eating the kind of metallic poison they put in those things or flu shots. And so he needs to get that metallic poison out some other way so he doesn't have to keep growing staph.
For all your 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu merchandise, please visit 10thplanetjj.com/shop. We also got a Look Into It t-shirt that just dropped. Thank you very much for your support.
Now, there are a lot of people, I have a lot of friends and family who got, tricked and like forced and got their jobs threatened and all that stuff. And they got the first 2 shots. They didn't get the boosters. I know a lot of people who got the first 2, but then they decided, you know, not to get the boosters. Is there a process to get that shit out of your system?
Well, so since I haven't been doing medicine for 2.5 years, so I haven't been working with people like that, right? Because
yeah.
I said clearly before this whole thing that if that would be the worst mistake you ever make, because you don't know what's in there, and I don't know what's in there, and nobody knows what's in those shots. And so nobody can tell you, here's what you do to get rid of it. Because if you don't know what's in it, how are you going to know how to get it out?
Correct.
Now, I do know some things that probably will help based on whatever happens. But, you know, I mean, that was a horrible mistake those people made.
Absolutely,
and,
man.
And I'm, you know, I'm very careful about, like, I'm not doing medicine here. I can just tell you that this is a horrible mistake, and we don't really know, and I don't really know how to get it out because we don't even know what went in. And I'm just going to leave it there for now.
I get it, man. I get it, man. It's the crazy thing is with all this stuff coming out over the last 6 months, it's been really clear in the 6 months, but if you really were paying attention, you could see, you know, the heart attacks in regards to the jab back when, like, DMX had a heart attack and he got jabbed, and people, they didn't even talk about that. And he died like a year ago. And the people that were having heart attacks early on, they really didn't jump on that. But now, anytime someone has a stroke or heart issues and collapses, boom, people are starting to see it now. They're like, it's like trending. Like, did he get jabbed? Is he vaccinated? It's starting to swell. People are starting to wake up. Not everybody. There's still a lot of zombie sheep out there. But it seems like anytime someone has a heart attack, you're like, ooh, did he get jabbed? You still have Fauci out there and Joe Biden, get vaccinated. You got to get vaccinated. Like, still? You guys are still saying this shit? It's crazy. And Bill Gates, just like last week, I don't know if you've seen this, Bill Gates said, you know what? It doesn't really work that well. You know, it doesn't work good for old people, and it doesn't stop the infection. And it doesn't.
There is no infection.
Yeah, I know. He's like, he's saying that it was bullshit.
You know, but anyways, I mean, that's a whole issue in itself, which I'm mostly not getting into, because to me, the interesting part and the important part is the thinking process.
Yes.
Let me tell you what I mean by that. So I had a guy that I knew is a doctor, you know, sort of a friend kind of. 20 years ago, he started treating AIDS patients with HIV drugs. And I told him, there's no HIV. You can demonstrate that easily. It's a totally make-believe. There's no evidence for anything called HIV. All you're doing is poisoning him with drugs. But he didn't believe me. He didn't look into it. He didn't listen. And so he spent his career believing in viruses and trying to kill viruses, right?
Yes.
So naturally, then when so-called COVID strikes, he goes and gets injected. The fourth injection next day or 2 days later, dead in his bed from a stroke or a heart attack. Mm. Now, here's the question. Why did he die? Now, most people would say he died because of the injection, right? Mm-hmm. But I think he died because of the way he thought. He thought there were viruses. He thought in order to protect yourself against viruses, you have to do such and such, like inject yourself with this stuff. Thoughts lead to actions. Actions have consequences. And so naturally, he took the injection and then that killed him. The important point, the way to stop this is not going on about the jabs, because that in a way makes it worse. Now, people, in a way, this may be actually planned. Now, if you've gotten the injection and you've got you, and I'm not blaming you, but there's everybody out there saying, you know, you idiot, you're going to die. Now it's like, holy shit, you know, what did I do? And so in a funny sort of way, it actually makes it worse. Whereas the problem is, if you believe in viruses, you are going to make a mistake someday, because the way you think and your belief system leads you to take actions like this guy. Actions then have consequences, and then you'll have a bad outcome.
Everything your government has told you about this virus is a lie.
Trust the experts, trust the experts.
Are you afraid of the flu? Don't bother me. I mean, that's the reality of how people perceive flu. So we really do have a problem of how the world perceives influenza, and it's going to be very difficult to change that unless you do it from within and say, I don't care what your perception is, we're going to address the problem in a disruptive way and in an iterative way, because you do need both.
Make sure you wear your mask at all times. Do your part. It is a federal crime. We catch you with that mask below your nose.
Don't ask questions.
Do what you are told. It is for your safety.
We have 33 confirmed positive tests.
COVID-19 in Thailand remains at 33.
33. 33. 33. 33. There were 33 cases in North Carolina.
33. There was 33 everywhere.
I think that was Red Team Go. I think 33 yes. is like Red Team Go. Everybody goes, okay, let's do it. It's time.
89% until 94% of those PCR tests are false positive.
It doesn't tell you that you're sick, and it doesn't tell you that the thing you ended up with really was going to hurt you or anything like that.
Everyone who's listed as a COVID death doesn't mean that that was the cause of the death.
We didn't understand that it's a fairly low fatality rate and that it's a disease mainly of the elderly, kind of like flu is.
This isn't going to be run on CNN for a week.
No flu to be found.
You got lied to. Who fell for this shit?
We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin.
Why are we being pressured to add COVID?
You're exactly right.
Yeah.
You are correct. I should not be giving these vaccines at all.
You've been subject to propaganda and lies by people who are very well trained in how they do that.
Only one person in the entire state died from the flu.
So when you deny this stuff, or when you don't want to believe this stuff, you don't want to face reality, it's only hurting you.
They relied on people's ignorance.
Everybody sees what's going on. People woke up, man. They're not looking for anybody to save them. They're saving themselves.
There's your flu last year. Here's your flu this year. Literally doesn't even exist.
So the whole thing needs to be addressed at the root of the problem, which is we have delusional thinking, which is easy to show. That's why we talked about the whole thing in the first half an hour.
Yes. Yes. Now, you have a different viewpoints. You have different viewpoints on heart disease and what causes heart attacks, correct? Can we get into that a little bit?
I do. So what causes heart attacks? Everybody knows.
They say cholesterol, right? Or
that's too specific.
High blood pressure or something?
No, let's be very clear. The reason people, the cardiologists, internists, all the whole medical establishment says you have three coronary arteries in your, those are big arteries that carry the blood to your heart, right?
Okay. Yes.
They get blocked with something, maybe cholesterol, maybe inflammation, maybe something else. They get blocked. The blood can't get through and downstream dies because there's no blood flow. That's why you have a heart attack, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, we could argue about what causes the blockage, but that's a separate issue. That let's talk about the issue, which is they say that blocked arteries cause heart attacks.
Correct.
Okay. Here's a scenario, because I wrote a book about this. I had hundreds, maybe thousands of people came to me and they said, remember, this part of this story is you have three coronary arteries. And they say all the blood to your heart goes through these three arteries. So if one gets blocked, then it's bad news. Okay?
Okay.
Man walks up a hill with his wife. Doesn't feel so good, has chest pain, right? Wife says, you got to go to the doctor. Goes to the cardiologist. I've heard this story hundreds of times.
Let me guess. Cardiologist says he has climate change. No, I'm kidding. I'm Maybe. Sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Cardiologist does this, some tests. He says, you've got a 95% blockage in your right coronary artery. And then he usually wags his finger and says, if you block any more, you're going to die of a heart attack. So we need to put a stent in. We need to bypass that artery, or we need to give you statin drugs to lower your cholesterol because that's what the blockage is, right?
Yes.
Okay. Let's think about this for a minute. You got three arteries. That's where the blood comes from. This guy just told you, you have only 5% blood flow to a major part of your heart, right?
Right.
Because you're 95% blocked. How did you walk up a hill?
Okay, so the doctor's full of shit.
No, there's a 95% blockage. You see it on an angiogram.
Okay.
Now, here's another question for you, Eddie. You're 95% blocked, meaning you have 5% blood flow, right?
Okay.
If you block down to 3%, that's going to kill you. You're going to have a heart attack.
Got it.
You believe that?
I don't know.
Well, don't know. Do you think there's a difference between 5% and 3%?
You know, you put it that way, I could see how that kind of doesn't make sense.
That does not make sense.
Yeah.
I worked in a cardiac cath lab. I saw this over and over again. Person asymptomatic. They living their life normally. They had three arteries, all 90% or more blocked. I said, what the hell? How they have 5% blood flow. How are they living? Well, nothing. You mean to say if you block from 5% to 3%, that's going to kill you? Like that, if you got 5% blood flow, you got no blood flow.
That sounds pretty low. That sounds low. Okay.
I didn't believe it at all right then. I said, this cannot be.
So what do you think's going on?
Well, so then I looked at all of the studies from 1930 till the present day. What percentage of people who died of a heart attack, right? So these are the worst of the worst.
Okay.
Have a significant blockage in the artery leading to that part of the heart. And I found various papers through the years. The one paper, the highest percentage was 78%. Blockage. The lowest paper was 18% had a blockage, and the other 82% had no blockage.
Hmm.
But even if it's the highest one, 78%, what happened to the other 22%? They didn't have any blockage. Why did they die? They died of a heart attack. No blockage. Hmm. Now, then I found the best paper ever written on this by a guy named Giorgio Baroldi, who said, I did autopsies 50 years on people died of heart attacks. 41% of them have a blockage. That means 59% don't. And then he said, of the 41%, half of them came after the heart attack, not before. In other words, they had a heart attack and then they got a blockage, meaning only 20% had a blockage before they had a heart attack. Which brings the question up, what happened to the other 80%? They didn't even have a blockage.
Yeah.
Now, so then I looked at the studies on stents and bypasses, and it's very clear they have no benefit. Nobody lives longer. They don't prevent heart attacks. They don't keep you out of the hospital. They don't help you live longer.
The stents,
meaning they put a tube in your to unblock your artery.
Yes. Okay.
$50 billion a year industry. It's the most common procedure in the United States most years.
The most common procedure.
Medical procedure.
Overall?
Overall.
Wow. Wow, I know one person who got stents, actually two. But man, I didn't know it was number one. That's interesting.
I mean, it depends what you mean, not like pap smears, right? So you could say that.
You're talking about like surgery, right? Because they have to open up your heart, right?
No, it's
like,
they just put a catheter in.
Oh, so it's like they're sticking.
They just
like
put a catheter in, find the blockage. They put a tube in that keeps it open. And then the blood can go back through.
Hmm.
You're not allowed to tell somebody it will make you live longer or prevent further heart attacks. That's considered malpractice. You can just say that it will relieve your pain. But then they did a double-blind study published in The Lancet 2018 showing that when they did a placebo, they did the catheter and they didn't put a stent in. They told them they put a stent in, but they didn't. They had the same relief of the pain as the people they put a stent in.
Hmm.
So there is no benefit. Now,
is there something sticking out? Like they put something in?
No, they just put it in your artery.
So like it's like a needle or something that they stick in? Like I'm trying to figure out, like trying to wrap my brain around how they
like
put something in.
It's like a steel mesh tube.
And how do they stick it in with it? Like some kind of needle, like a syringe?
Yeah, they put a needle in and they snake the catheter all the way to your artery and your and then they basically find it and squeeze it open.
That's insane that they could even do that. That's crazy.
So That showed me, and should show anybody who looks, that A, this is not the problem. A, and B, it's not possible that all the blood flow to the heart is from these arteries. In fact, if you actually look at the blood flow to the heart, and I have pictures, but I can't pull them up right now. The heart blood flow is more like a watershed or a lake than it is a river. And so the blood, only a very small percentage goes through these coronary arteries. So it's like washing over with small blood vessels, which that's where the blood flow to the heart comes from. Now, then the question, why do you get a heart attack? Now, you probably know from exercise. So we have two kinds of ways we generate energy. One is aerobically and the other is anaerobically. When you have anaerobic respiration, you create lactic acid, and that causes pain and cramps in the muscle. It happens in the leg. It happens in any muscle in the body. By the way, the other thing that tipped me off that something was wrong, let me again ask you some questions.
Okay.
So they say that there's a blockage in an artery, right?
Right.
Yes or no? The arteries all over the bodies are basically the same. To your spleen, your liver, your brain, your heart, it's all the same arteries.
I don't know.
The answer is yes.
Okay.
There's right. not, you don't have a special artery to your heart and a special one to your brain. It's all the same.
Okay. I didn't know that. Okay.
Okay. Now, the whole theory of the plaque is there's something in your blood that's depositing in your blood vessel, right?
Right.
Like cholesterol or yes. something. Now, true or false, the blood to all the rest of your body is the same blood as the blood that goes through your heart.
True.
True. Obviously.
Yeah.
So if the blood is the same and the vessel is the same, and the problem is there's too much of this stuff in the blood, so it's depositing in the vessel, then you have the same, if you take the artery that goes to your spleen or your liver, that must also have too much of that same stuff. Right?
Okay. Yeah, correct.
Right? Because yes, same blood, same stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And in fact, you do get plaque buildup in your splenic artery. That's the artery that goes to your spleen.
Okay.
Right? So you have plaque in your coronary arteries, plaque in your splenic artery. Now, if plaque in the arteries caused attacks, have you ever heard of somebody who had a heart attack?
Have I ever heard of someone who had a heart attack?
Or know somebody personally?
My grandfather and my uncle, they
and Dick Cheney and Bill Clinton and
yeah.
thousands and thousands and millions of people.
Yes.
Right? You agree?
I agree.
Now, how many people have you heard of or know personally who had a spleen attack?
None.
How about a liver attack?
I don't even know what a spleen is, to tell you the truth. What does that do? What does the spleen
It doesn't do? Matter. What about a liver attack?
Nope.
How about a kidney attack?
Nope.
How about a foot attack?
Nope.
Why not? They get plaque too.
Yep. I see where you're going with that.
There's a problem, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Why? Yeah. Like why?
Why your heart? So here's the reason. When you exceed your aerobic capacity because you're in bad shape, because you have poor small blood vessels, because you're toxic, because you have a lot of things, then your body has to switch from using oxygen to fermenting fuel, which creates lactic acid. And then your leg hurts, right? You've seen that.
Yeah.
Then you make, because your leg hurts, you stop moving. And then the lactic acid flushes out, and then you go back and you don't have a leg attack. The heart and the brain, which you have strokes, they can't stop. Every other organ can stop. Your heart can't stop, so it accumulates this lactic acid. First, you feel pain. That's called angina. Then the lactic acid accumulates, and you get a localized acidic buildup, and that destroys the tissue. That's what we call a heart attack. Every single heart attack has lower pH in the tissue. That's the cause of the heart attack, because something happened to your ability to generate fuel. This is a metabolic disturbance. And by the way, there's a medicine called strophanthus that flushes out the lactic acid and fixes the problem right away. It's been known for over 100 years.
Whoa, 100 years. What's it called again?
It's the extract of the seeds of strophanthus. Because the problem, every single heart attack is caused by a drop in the pH, which causes acidification and necrosis of the tissue, and that's what we call a heart attack. And the reason it happens in your heart and not your leg or your kidneys is if the acid starts building up in your kidneys, the kidney shuts down, the acid gets flushed out, and it goes back to normal. Can't happen in your heart. Your heart has to keep expanding and contracting. And so it has nothing to do with the blood vessels. It has everything to do with the muscle of the heart. Now, once that happens and you get death of the tissue, then you get debris buildup, just like if you put debris in a river, right? You put a dam in a river, upstream you'll get debris buildup, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That came after the dam. So the blockage, as this guy Baroldi said, comes after the heart attack, not before. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense of every observation you can see. This is a metabolic problem, an energy problem. Your heart is not generating the energy that it needs because of poisons, bad food, lack of movement, electromagnetic fields. You have crappy relationships, you think stupid thoughts, and I could go on.
So, right? So you're saying a heart attack is like a cramp of the heart.
And it starts as a cramp, but then the difference is, unlike your leg, which you cramp and then keeps going, and the acid builds up just like it would in your leg if you kept going, and then you'd get a breakdown of your leg muscle, but nobody does that because the cramp seizes up the muscle.
And you just stop. And you're like, oh, I got a cramp. Stop. Hold on, I got a cramp. Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, I never looked at it like that. I actually had no idea what causes. I mean, I thought like just like bad diet and you know, just
I mean that bad diet makes it's actually the mitochondria that generate this energy. So mitochondria are susceptible to metals, antibiotics, vaccines, bad diet, bad relationships, everything. You know, they essentially make our fuel. If you poison them, then you eventually run out of fuel. You have to use the backup system that generates acids. The acids cause a cramp. Eventually, it causes breakdown of the tissue. That causes blockages to build up. And that is exactly what you see over and over again. This is very clear.
Now, that substance you were talking about that we've had for over 100 years that can fix the heart attack, is that something that you suggest taking on a regular basis, like a supplement?
Well, just to be clear, it improves your energy generation in all of your tissues. So It helps your brain function better. It helps your heart function better. And it helps you live a longer and healthier life. That's what the studies show. And it does that because one of the reasons you get sick is your ability to generate energy becomes weak. And then you feel tired first, and then you don't generate energy. And then a whole lot of things happen after that. And so, yes, that has been for at least 100 years.
And how do you spell that? I'm gonna go buy some right now. How do you spell that?
So I'm like, here's an issue here.
You don't want to recommend it. Is that what it is? Well, because you can get in trouble.
Here's the thing. I am, you know, like it or not, I'm the person in the United States who has been speaking about Strophanthus extracts for 15 years. And we ended up, because it's a seed from Africa, grows it. It's a long vine. It makes seeds, like sort of like a coconut makes seeds. And you have to make an extract or a powder of the seeds. And you have to be very careful about how you do it. And we're the only company in the United States that carries Strophanthus seed extract. So it's a little bit like I don't like to go on shows and, you know, commercially tout my own horn, because that seems weird. But I can tell you, if the only place to get this of the genuine Strophanthus seed extract is from our company.
Beautiful. As long as I can get it, I'll order some after we're done here. I'm serious. And,
you know, interestingly, the natives collected from the Cameroon, which is a country in West Africa, and they call it the gift from paradise, because all diseases are a consequence of decreased energy, right? Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, you don't have the energy to flush out the poisons. You don't have the energy to move to help flush out the poison. You don't have the energy to think properly. You don't have the energy in your lungs to clear out the mucus. You don't have the energy in your heart to generate fuel properly and create this electromagnetic field. So when you say, how could it be the treatment or help support many different diseases? Because it's working on a fundamental level, which is disease comes when you run out of energy.
Now, did you find out about the Strophanthus seed extract when you were in South Africa for that period of time? Is that?
No.
And okay, so what is the history behind this seed, and like, and how did they figure out it was good for the heart and the brain?
You know, the natives used it as a heart tonic, and when they, you know, eventually came on it and said, "What is this stuff?" And it's become one of the most studied substances in the medical literature, because it has an active ingredient called wabaine, which is used for dealing with a lot of issues in medicine and research, et cetera. And so basically, like most plant extracts, it came because the native people were using it already, and they just said, "What are you doing with this?" And they figured it out.
Wow. Wow. Man, how?
By the way, Eddie, I'm going to have to go in about 10 minutes. So just
I got you. No, no, Dad, I'm glad you stayed this long. Now, how can my people reach you and order some of this stuff?
So I have two websites.
I know you're not into, you know, you feel kind of weird selling it, but man, I'm really interested, and I'm sure I'm going to get mad emails saying, "Hey, what was the name of that stuff? How do I get it?"
Yeah, it's so the website is drtomcowan.com. There's also a website called Dr. Cowan's Garden, drcowans.com. And the Dr. Cowan's Garden is more food that we carry.
Okay.
And Dr. Tom Cowan is more the medicine part. So we have different things to help with water and different herbs, and they all come out of my understanding of, you know, why you get sick is you poison your water and then you have to cough it up. And if we can help you cough it up or not poison yourself, that's how you get better. So that's where we sell this Trifanthus seed extract.
I think we just pulled it up.
Yeah.
There we
that's go. The food one.
In that food one, I could get the Strophanthus too?
No.
No.
The Strophanthus is on that one. So you go to shop.
Okay.
And Strophanthus, there you go.
And how often do you take that? Strophanthus.
You'll read about it. There's a lot of information on the website where we get it. You know, books, articles, etc. It's used usually 2 to 3 times a day, either one capsule or 10 to 20 drops. And it explains it in there.
Okay. Wow. Man, Tom, you're awesome. You're doing great work. My people are going to love this one. This is a great one. It's a great one to go along with what, you know, what Andrew Coffin's been saying as well. Thank you very much. And hopefully we can do part two.
Okay, Eddie, thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
You are a good sport with all the questions I asked you.
Oh, I live for this, man. I love it, man. Thank you. I appreciate everything. Thank you.
Okay, take care, Eddie.
Bye.
The Jiu-Jitsu Dojo is the ultimate training ground for life. Jiu-Jitsu will accelerate the evolution of your being, your consciousness, your soul. Through this amazing art, you will prove to yourself that you can master anything you set your mind to.
Happy birthday, Eddie Bravo.
I leave for Brazil tomorrow.
I'm Naruto Abu Dhabi.
Are you the Fear Factor guy?
I'm like 6 pounds over. Time to sweat it out.
Just imagine someone that has no idea how different your game is.
I'll tell you what this weekend was, man. It was a culmination point where all your hard work comes to like one great moment in time. You showed that you're a fucking champion, guy who goes against convention. You created your own shit and figured interesting ways to get around problems in jiu-jitsu. And shows you that great things are possible if you work hard, if you dedicate yourself and you use your creativity and you push through, your own human potential just goes up.
My 10th Planet Association has grown rapidly to over 70 academies worldwide, and their curriculums are all synced to 10th Planet headquarters located in downtown Los Angeles. I'm Eddie Bravo. I hope to see you on the mats.
You can tell it's real because it looks so fake.